and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The day today is February 24th, 2022, and this is episode 318. I'm the ghost, Mark Ames, here, sleepless in Rochester, New York, up on the very north, on the shores of Great Lake Ontario, and I'm on the line with the Warner, Gary Brecher, K. John Dolan, on the other end of Lake Ontario in Toronto. So first of all, how you doing, John?
Yeah, well, I mean, they could have, he said selfishly, picked a better time to invade because we just got our boosters yesterday, and although I didn't have any reaction to the first two shots, this booster has kind of laid me low,
and
I'm not at my best for dealing with a pretty grim series of events in the past 24 hours.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. Yeah, it's funny, when I had my shots, my first one, I had a very weird reaction almost immediately, and it lasted about a day and a half. It was like a lightheaded fever and some various reactions, and it went away. And the second one, I think I complained about this last year, but I had some kind of like just sort of ongoing tiredy, flu-y symptoms that went on for weeks. And I kept thinking, am I imagining this? And when it finally went away, I realized I hadn't imagined it. And then afterwards, I found that with a small percentage of people, they had something similar to that. And the third shot, I had zero, which kind of weirded me out. I mean, not even a slight anything at all. It was like nothing happened. Mm. And so it's kind of...
Yeah, well, this one, I think, is getting better, because yesterday you could have used my head to, you know, the way... the traditional cooking method of throwing hot stones in a hole and covering them up, my head would have been fine. Mm. But it's cooled off a little now. But then, so I wake up and I find we've got...
It happened.
We have something to deal with. Yeah.
Yeah, it happened. You know, our wish came true, John.
Yeah. We said tempting fate.
Yes.
Unwisely.
Hubris, I believe it's called. Yeah.
That it would be nice just to be wrong once in a while. And we were wrong.
Yeah, very wrong. And wrong on something of massive importance in our area of knowledge and interest, and wrong against the very people we were taunting for being wrong.
The bastards were right in this case. And you said something when we were talking about this that I think, I mean, we're talking, of course, about the massive Russian invasion of Ukraine. And you said something that I've been thinking about since, which is one factor in the way we process things is that whatever the U.S. intelligence analysis elite is feeding the tame media is almost always going to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it seems like they had good intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that makes sense when you're talking about a massive military buildup that can be shown from space. But again, I really thought there was going to be a classic dog behind a fence, running up to the fence and barking to make your point, and then nothing more. But that turned out to be a preparation for a real and all-out invasion, as far as I can see.
That's, it just kind of hit me. Actually, I hadn't even thought about this when we were talking or any time earlier. Like, why is it this time the intelligence was good? Well, who's the head of the CIA right now? I mean, I was, you won't find me much on record. I'm not like a big fanboy of the CIA, obviously. But even when he was named, Bill Burns, when he was named to head the CIA, I don't know. I noticed I wasn't alone, certainly. I noticed a lot of people who had some kind of experience with Russia reporting were like, wow, that's interesting. This is a guy who actually knows Russia well, and you know he knows it well because... this was like one of the headline stories 10 years ago when the WikiLeaks cables were leaked. and Burns' cables on Russia were like literary works of art. I mean, they were brilliant. Wow. Some of them were funny. His, like, he just had a very deep, like, he'd gone through several stages and had just a very deep grasp of what was going on there. I don't know why I didn't think of this before. It's kind of funny. And of course, so it, certainly he knows it, you know, it gets to the question of what's the purpose of intelligence. Is the purpose of intelligence to deceive, you know, everyone to help run the empire? Is the purpose of intelligence to keep the leaders informed, you know, feeding them the best information so that they can act on the best information? I mean, you know, obviously it should be number two, and invariably it's almost always number one. But Burns really was good. I don't know if this has something to do with it. I'm remembering right now, there's this cable, one of the cables. Well, there are cables that are hilarious, actually. Him describing, like, I don't know, a Dagestani wedding that he went down when he went and visited Dagestan. Some of it's just brilliant. But here's a cable from WikiLeaks cable. Just popping it up here. I hope I find the right parts. It's February 1st, 2008. And it says here, summary. Following a muted first reaction to Ukraine's intent to seek a NATO membership action plan at the Bucharest summit, this is when all this actually started, Foreign Minister Lavrov and other senior officials have reiterated strong opposition, stressing that Russia would view further eastward expansion as a potential military threat. NATO enlargement, particularly to Ukraine, remains, quote, an emotional and neuralgic, unquote, issue for Russia.
Yeah, I saw that and I thought, neuralgic?
I know.
Okay, that might be the right word, yeah.
Yeah. But strategic policy considerations also underlie strong opposition to NATO membership for Ukraine and Georgia. In Ukraine, these include fears that the issue could potentially split the country in two, leading to violence or even some claim civil war, which would force Russia to decide whether to intervene. This is really prophetic, man. Additionally, the GRN experts continue to claim that Ukrainian NATO membership would have a major impact on Russia's defense industry, Russian-Ukrainian family connections, bilateral relations in general. And then it goes on and there, like it gets deeper into it. But here's Ukraine and Georgia's NATO aspirations not only touch a raw nerve in Russia, they engender serious concerns about the consequences for stability in the region. Not only does Russia perceive encirclement and efforts to undermine Russia's influence in the region, but it also fears unpredictable and uncontrolled consequences which would seriously affect Russian security interests. And so on and so on. And talking about civil war and that Russia would have to intervene. He had a sense of how serious it really was and that they were. And then you have to wonder, well, then, you know, why didn't they do more? And I mean, we talked about this earlier. Like, one thing I definitely don't want to do here is let Putin off the hook as if
absolutely
he is purely
not
a victim.
Yeah.
I do want to criticize the many things that, you know, our side did. And presumably, we're a democracy, and presumably, we can actually affect our leadership and yada, yada, yada. But that's true. And our side did a lot. I mean, it's a failure. If there's an invasion, it means it's a failure. And it goes back to this kind of stuff. Putin is 100% responsible. He could have reacted to all of this in so many different ways. Even this specifically, he could have had a litany of plans. I mean, when we talk about getting this wrong, you know, like I thought it was bluff that was going to be something kind of kinetic. And then as things really heated up the last few days, the last like 5 days or so, I thought, okay, they're going to do like a turkey thing, move in, maybe expand the cordon sanitaire and just basically keep destabilizing Ukraine. But the World War II style, I don't know if this you'd call this World War II style yet, but it's close enough that it qualifies, you know?
Yeah.
But I still completely dismissed it right up to the last minute because...
Well, because that seemed like a better strategy.
Yes,
it seemed like a much better... I mean, I was trying to come up with explanations for this because it still doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But I I was thinking, okay, maybe like a lot of would-be pundits, I overestimated the degree to which the Russian leadership is thinking about the world audience and underestimated how the feelings of their domestic audience. But that doesn't seem to be it. I don't get the sense that there's massive nationalist enthusiasm for this move in Russia, at least not so far.
I think, I mean, among the real nationalists, there's a lot of enthusiasm, but that's okay. That's not a big part of the electorate.
I mean, we're going to be hearing from every dissident now.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean that they're the majority either.
No.
I don't get the feeling that, you know, everybody was in the streets saying on to Kiev now.
No, they didn't. And in fact, you know, the TV reports are really heavily sanitizing what's going on there. And I know that that happens a lot. Our media does that voluntarily a lot, but like much more heavily sanitizing than you would expect. And because they know it's really not that popular, it's divisive. I can say that there are a lot of people who very much supported or like were identified with Putin's speech, the long speech, the list of grievances speech, but who were still after that, and myself included, shocked that that led to an actual full-scale bombing of Ukraine and do not support it. They're not gonna, you know, they're not gonna mass in the streets, partly because they're scared. After, I mean, Putin, a lot of things are starting to fall into place and make sense. Why did he go after Navalny so hard? Why did they do a really harsh crackdown? It was a year ago, January 2021. Navalny came back after being poisoned. You know, he landed, he kind of bravely faced it down, was immediately jailed. And there were those big protests and there were thousands and thousands and thousands of arrests. And they showed that like they weren't going to go sort of semi-soft on protesters anymore, that it was... things were going to get dark fast. And I remember Navalny from prison called off, you know, at first he was saying, let's keep protesting. And something happened. And he called on everybody to call off the protests and told people to basically get out of the business and keep safe. And he clearly, I think, foresaw that there was a real deep shift that had gone on. And now it makes sense. I mean, Putin, it seems to me, he's been planning to make major changes in his neighborhood and what he sees as his neighborhood and major changes in the way, in relations. Like the
one question. Should we, is Putin the right term or are we talking about?
I think
about...
so, absolutely. No.
Okay.
So there's Putin and I've rarely seen a leader like so fully in control. And I've seen Putin through the years. I remember him in the days when he, you know, he was like this sort of commanding figure, but he still answered to a lot of various kind of oligarchs, interest groups, the Yeltsin family, so on and so forth. And then he started taking down oligarchs, but he was still, then he was like in control, but it was very different. The Putin that I've seen in the last week is I don't know, I hate to use the word dictator but that's what it is. I mean, he's a ruler. Right. He's a iron-fisted ruler who completely dominates everybody, completely.
So we're not even necessarily talking about a decision made by a large elite here.
He brought together his National Security Council and sat on one end, and you know, because he's COVID shy, and then the others sat like, you know, 50 feet away on the other end, and he had each of them say what they should do, and they all said we must recognize the LNR, DNR, and you know, the Luhansk People's Republic and the Donetsk People's Republic, the two separatist regions, and one of them's Sergei Naryshkin, who's the head of the SVR, the Foreign Service, was kind of fumbling his words, and Putin I've seen this before. I've seen this with powerful Russian businessmen in that kind of oligarch world. I had friends who worked very high up in that world, and I've seen how kind of scary, and it's very different from what you a version in America, and it's Okay, you know, not all cultures are the same. It's a different culture. It's more what we would think of as like hard-ass gangster, you know, not gangster, yeah, even yeah, like organized crime boss talk. And I don't mean that to be, you know, all Russians are organized crime. I'm just trying to provide a reference here, you know, yeah, of how hard-ass they can talk to each other. He had Naryshkin like shaking. I've never seen something like that before. That was pretty insane.
And mentioned that, yeah, Zelensky in his last minute speech, oh, yeah, oh, also, man, looked terrified.
That's when you knew like it was for sure, yeah, something, yeah, big, because his swagger was gone. I think I'm assuming that he just didn't believe it. I mean, look, we were wrong with a lot of people, including Volodymyr Zelensky. Over and over, yeah, he kept saying nothing's, yeah, changed. His national security chief, there were a lot of people, a lot of Russians.
Yeah, they kept telling the Americans, stop, you know, yeah, stop telling us we're about to be invaded. We don't, yeah, see it. I went with him.
There is always the kind of meta reality of social media and media fights, which has such an outsized influence. And I see people fighting some of those fights right now. I hate it. I don't want it. But like, in that world right now, there's sort of one group of just the horrible people got this right? Like the neocons, yep, and the Bob Kagans and the Atlantic Council people, all the people, if you want their world, man, it's coming because they, yeah, got this one right. The red-brown hunters, you know what I mean? They're like, yeah, they're saying anybody who was not saying that this is a massive invasion is red-brown, Putin lover, like all, yeah, this kind of
and
crap.
And there will be champagne in the offices, yeah, of McDonnell Douglas and Raytheon.
Oh, God, and, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hell yeah. Yeah, when I saw Zelensky's speech, he looked to me, I've watched his show, Sluga Naroda, which is, you can watch it on Netflix. The very first episode is actually really good. I think it's still on Netflix. And it was like he gave one of those speeches, kind of like from the TV show, which is kind of weird, where it's like he's talking, this is why he got elected. He's talking to you in a real language, quote unquote, real, authentic, and it does feel real. It's like he's saying, forget all this political talk, and like, I'm appealing to you directly. And he does, and it seems sincere. He's an actor, you know, a comedian, and I think he believes it too. And but the speech was different in that he was white. He was chalk white with like sweat under his nose and on his chin, and kept kind of licking his lips. Whereas Putin, in his two speeches, the big hour-long, you know, I'm sick of getting the hi-hat speech, that one, and then the even the much more disturbing one, which is the one basically announcing the war. It was like a rehash of the longer speech, just sort of the highlights, but very bitterly told.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, yeah, the hi-hat reference is, of course, to Miller's Crossing and
right,
Johnny Casper. But even Johnny Casper never got as directly threatening. I mean, I saw a video of bits of that second, mm-hmm, very scary speech.
Yes.
Special military operation, and then anyone who interferes with this will suffer consequences never seen in history. Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty scary.
Like Trump
stuff
would say that kind of thing, but no one would really take him seriously.
Yeah, because he doesn't know what it means anyway.
Exactly.
No one,
exactly.
And Putin knows exactly what it means. And
yeah,
that's why it's scary.
I mean, I've been saying this to people too, though. Like when it comes to NATO, you know, Putin's bluff or poker game or whatever is brutal honesty. It's, yeah, but what's different now is he used to always understate things always. And what's unusual, among other things, you know, is this is it's quite the opposite. I mean, he talked a lot. He let the sort of the deep rumbling well of grievances, he aired them all out. Not emotionally. He was very lucid and very like, this is the reality. This is a matter of fact, and I'm going to lay out everything that's happened to us, every wrong that's been done to us by the West. Every time we tried to be good players, you know, obviously it's not like Russia was always innocent, but there's a lot of truth to what he said. There's definitely a lot of truth. That was,
well, I mean, the whole thrust of the Exiles editorials was like, do you know what you're doing to these people?
Yeah.
And they're going to remember.
Yeah. And they did. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They did. And, you know, it's that old, I think we mentioned this a few times, but that old sort of Nietzsche adage about, well, he was making a point about there's no such thing as equilibrium, demonstrated by the fact that when somebody deeply emotionally wounds somebody else, the one who does the wounding doesn't even remember it. The one who's wounded carries with it for life, and it's more real years later even than when it happened, you know, and there's no equilibrium on that.
People have been, and I was guilty of this too, have been looking for the subtext and the possible gesture meaning of Putin's warnings and speeches, and that we're jumping too quickly from text to subtext, and it's better to pay attention to what they were actually saying, because they meant it.
And doing, they meant it. So that's why, I mean, leave aside the Bob Kagans, but even guys like Rob Lee, who has always been a really good open source, he's with a military background, he's been very good on Russia, not a crazed sort of Russophobe or, you know, Putin is evil all the time, very kind of just matter of fact. And I was like about to scold him at some point, like, you know, you've just ruined your credibility by saying there's going to be war, you know. he was obviously very, very right about it. And he kept saying over and over, like, this means something. These forces are there. Like, this means something very, very big. It's not the usual thing. It has only one purpose in the military world. And it's something really big. And you can't even... It's like any army. You can't hold an army, but you know, this is through history. You can't just mass an army like that and it's not going to be used. Or it's very hard to anyway, right?
I think it could be done. And I admit that's what I was thinking. You know, if you've seen the video of the two dogs on either side of a fence who just bark furiously until the gate is opened, and then it's like, yeah, I'm going to smell something over here. I was guessing that it was something like that. But it's very expensive in retrospect to move that number of troops. And they were.
But also like Putin's mood. You know, he let his guard down in a bit. He really did let his guard down, and he knew it because he's always been very, very guarded. Not a bluffer, not full of shit. He's always tried to be clear and say in few words, you know, what this means, what that means. And we never listen. But man, he just let it go. It was a long, long speech that I think people are going to be, this is a major event by any standard, so people are going to be talking about this, I think, for quite a long time.
So we should talk about what, I mean, let's get back into the wonderful business of predicting.
Here's what I see, John.
We don't even want to do that, but what we can say is there have been strikes everywhere in Ukraine. I mean, even in Ivano-Frankivsk in the southwest, which is amazing. So it could be an attempt to disable the Ukrainian military or just terrorize them, terrorize the Ukrainian state. Or it could be an attempt to partition everything. There seems to be a powerful armored thrust down the Dnieper Valley toward Kiev, which could involve taking Kiev. And all of a sudden, we have to take a lot of things that might have seemed alarmist very seriously, like the idea that there are lists and that the people on those lists in Kiev are in great danger. We had planned to have a guest on this show, for example, but our guest at the last minute said, I can't do this. It's too dangerous.
It's too dangerous. Yeah, I have been in contact with him. We were going to talk about the politics. We were going to talk about the things that, had there not been a massive invasion, that, you know, were consistent with what we've been saying, which he and all of his friends, this guy is really smart, young Ukrainian, lives in the greater Kyiv area, active in like leftist politics and so on, and just funny and smart guy. And then this shit happened, and he was like kind of nervous at first, didn't really know how to react. And as time got closer, he just said, look, I didn't predict this either. He said, because I said to him, I was like, holy shit, did I mispredict this or, you know, fail to predict this? And he said, so did I. Like, I thought it was going to be, he thought so, something similar to what we thought, which is they were going to move into this, into the newly independent countries or whatever you could, statelets, and then take some more land and up the pressure. Mm. And right. Now he's like, I he's watching like and hearing bombs going off, and you know, they took an airport about 20 miles outside of Kyiv, the Antonov airport, airfield. And there's constant talk that Russian forces have actually infiltrated into Kyiv. And he said, I have no idea what the political situation is going to be here now. I'm on top of the fact that I may have to run to a bomb shelter any minute, but you know, there could be, there's already a state of emergency. There could be Russians coming in, occupying, taking it over. And God, you know, what do occupying forces do, especially like in this situation? I mean, they look for people to round up. Or on the other hand, Zelensky, I mean, how much power does Zelensky even have? How much is he even running things? He's a Jewish comedian in a country, historically anti-Semitic country, full of wounded national, you know, humiliated veterans, angry as hell people.
Desperately poor.
And here's this Jewish comedian who humiliated them by winning so hugely. Who's he relying on right now? It's just like, it's so unsettled. So I told him, yeah, we don't want to get you in any trouble. And whenever, you know, anything we can do, I asked him to, if there's anything our community could do for him as well, to let us know. My wife has other friends, old friends in Kyiv, a mother of three, who's also in the Kyiv region, who has been going back and forth to bomb shelters with her three kids. You know, she sent my wife a photo of like the three little backpacks, and my wife has been like bawling her head off. I don't blame her. And trying to see if maybe we can even like house them here for a while. I mean, this all hits pretty close to home. It's awful. I know we got to talk about this war, and I'm going to keep, kind of digressing back, but I'm really shocked, I have to say, because I think one other thing that really came through in this speech and in the actions is that Putin and the non-metonymy, real Putin, and then the structure that supports him, does not take Ukrainians seriously. They're not really part of the calculus here. They're something that either the West instrumentalizes or Russia instrumentalizes. Right. They can be brought to heel or punished. Like he doesn't think of them the way in previous crises he's had such a better, smarter, nuanced counterinsurgency grasp of things. This is like anti-counterinsurgency. And to give you an example, a friend of mine there, somebody I know there, you know, wrote me and said, one thing that's kind of funny is like everybody I know who was pretty much like anti sort of the whole Maidan liberal EU kind of crowd, the neoliberal crowd, generally like lefty or anarchist or whatever. And some among them, some of them even were kind of Putin friendly just because Putin stuck a thumb in their eye, you know, and made life hard for them. That literally within hours of this shit starting, these people are now deep, visceral Ukrainian nationalists. And of course they are. What the hell do you think when you invade? Yeah. Who the hell wouldn't be, you know?
Yeah.
So that's going to be something he's going to have to deal with. And how is he going to deal with that? Suddenly it's like, oh, you're not so smart anymore, are you? It's going to be freaking ugly, man. Really ugly.
Yeah. We have, I don't even have much faith in this, but we have, I suppose, a kind of responsibility to make sense of it from Putin's view. And it's not easy because it doesn't make a lot of sense. But we've talked about at least a couple of possibilities. One is that he's just decided all my troubles come from the West, and yep. wall it off. This is something you were saying, right?
Yeah.
Wall it off and look to the East because I can get along with those people better. And so someone said, you know, Putin has just brought back the Iron Curtain, and maybe that's the intended strategy.
Yes. That worked well for the Soviet Union, right?
Yes.
I mean, the minute that came down, the Soviet Union was gone. And it's not that he's clearly not a communist lover, as his speech showed. He hates the communists.
Oh, wow. That's something when we have more time, we can get back to Putin's survey of Soviet history. It's, he was furious at them.
Yeah.
Like, these guys ruined Russia.
Did you get that one kind of nasty, the joke? He loved his just bitter jokes, the one about decommunization, because a lot of, like, intricately woven into anti-Russianism is anti-communism, especially among Ukrainian nationalists. So when they were destroying, like, monuments to the Great Patriotic War, World War II, that was part of decommunizatia. And he was saying, okay, you want real decommunizatia? Let's give you back the Ukraine that existed before there was communism, which was a tiny rump state, right? Or no state at all. And he says, there you'll have true, real, and then he used in a Ukrainian accent, like decommunizatia.
He was furious.
Yes.
And I haven't seen, I don't know. You know him better than I do, but
I know him not anymore.
No, but I mean, I haven't seen him furious on camera before.
Yeah.
Always very controlled. And I think that's what a lot of people admired about him.
Yeah.
And so, so that theory sort of accounts for the anger. Like, I've had enough. I've had enough from the West. We turn in the other direction now, so that all, in a way, all this provocation makes the dreaded Eurasianism thesis come true.
When you were talking about the bombing of the airport in Ivano-Frankivsk in the far West, there were like five objects that were pointed out by somebody online, I've sort of followed Christy Totaru, whose relevance I finally understood, because I was like, why is he bombing the hell out of this airport or airfield in Ivano-Frankivsk, among some other objects? And he pointed out, Putin mentioned them in his speech. He mentioned five objects, airfields in Kuhulov or something, and in outside of Kyiv, a port right near Odessa, and the Ivano-Frankivsk airfield. Definitely four or five places what he said is they have been all repurposed, refurbished, what he said, or remade by Americans or Anglos, so that all of them can become NATO adaptable. It's so that NATO could use them, and they would all become NATO-friendly bases as part of this. You're not part of NATO, but you're creepingly becoming essentially de facto a NATO member. And he said that basically these bases have been refurbished. He knows what they're for. And they're unacceptable. They're absolutely unacceptable. And these were the first things that were taken out, among other stuff. So along with air, the usual stuff like air defense systems, radar systems, and so on.
Yeah, and it's possible to do that now at low risk. I've seen video of what is definitely cruise missiles coming in. Cruise missiles are much slower, and they make a noise like a jet, and they look like, just a line.
Right.
And there have been lots of cruise missiles aimed at targets like that. These are military targets. They can't move. You can't move an air base around. You know where they are. It's easy to hit. But and when you talk about creeping, that was the other thesis that I was thinking of, although it doesn't fully account for this, or at least it definitely doesn't justify it in strategic terms. That if you're some sort of Putin wonk, or maybe Putinite wonk, or maybe Putin himself as the grand wonk in Moscow, it may seem, after a long, hard couple of decades in the 21st century, that there is, once you've let them in, there's no one, and China did the right thing. It didn't let them in until it was making money. But once you've let them in prematurely, as the dying Soviet Union did, you've allowed a boa constrictor to start winding its coils around you. And nothing works. Nothing, saying stop that doesn't work. Nothing works. because they've got this, they've got the money, they've got the NGOs, they've got the media, they've got the military aid, and all these things are working together. And the only sense I can make of this, and it is in no way a justification, is that you might think, okay, slow methods, chatty methods, soft power methods don't work. It's a doomed struggle. The only way is to hit the thing on the snout. And that's, I don't know, maybe that's what this
no,
is.
No, I do think so. I think he thinks that he needs to get the West's attention. And so much of this, that and he's obviously calculated that the West is essentially going to isolate Russia. And most likely Nord Stream 2 will be killed. And that's the way it goes.
That's one thing one of many, many things I don't understand about this. Like, why would Germany go along with that? It seemed, I asked.
I think they're scared.
Oh, they're actually scared of Russia. Right.
Yeah. And I think this is true of, you know, I don't know about broader Europeans, but European elites, they want to do business with Russia. They find us annoying, so on and so forth. But when it comes down to, oh my God, they're actually going to war, who is scarier? And like, what world is scarier? A world where America is no longer the security umbrella and Russia is, you know, powerful with China? Or, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, for all the woke talk and all this stuff, they're all like somewhere like kind of liberal white nationalists in some degree or another. It's just, I don't think it's avoidable. And to them, Russia is scary and barbarian and unpredictable, and China is even scarier and more alien. And, I think they would have done things differently. It apparently would have done things differently. I don't know. I don't know why the Europeans didn't do better diplomacy, because...
Yeah.
But you see, this is the thing. We make them go along with us. So, for example, a year ago, when the Biden administration decided, you know, here's a good idea, let's really turn this thing up and, you know, Ukraine a lot, we'll really throw Russia off, ha ha ha. And so we decided to adopt this very hawkish policy, push hard for Ukraine into NATO again, even after all these years and all this time. The one thing that the Germans said at that time was, you know, we're not going to like stop Nord Stream 2 though, because of this new policy. And it seems that a deal was worked out. Okay, well, you know, you let us run the sort of the Russia diplomacy and the policy, but we'll completely back off, stop all this talk of sanctioning Nord Stream 2, which they did, right? That same time that when Biden came to power, he lifted all these sanctions threats against Germany over Nord Stream 2, but also ramped up the heat on, to heat up sort of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. And so I guess to get back to your point, I just think they were not leading any of the diplomacy we did.
Yeah.
That is a really, seems to be a pretty stupid thing, but that's the way it goes. And they're just, I think ultimately they're just afraid of a world where America is not the security blanket.
I don't normally get that interested in or know that much about strategic thinkers or so-called strategic thinkers, but people have mentioned John Mearsheimer, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, and I'm starting to think maybe I should have read more of his stuff, because he always said there's one reason that Europe is at peace, and that's American hegemony, soft, nerfed up as NATO. And you pull that back and it won't happen anymore. States always assume an anarchic world around them in which you don't settle for enough power. You try to get as much power as you can, assuming that everybody else in your vicinity means you harm. And
sounds very Putin-y.
makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll have to read that guy now. So we've had a good lesson in not predicting, so maybe we should stay away from what's going to happen now.
Yeah. It's even hard to say what is actually happening because fog of war. What seems to have happened that I think we can say with some certainty is Russian, where it seems like the Russian forces have at least announced that they have, you know, already taken territory that's very valuable around Novokhovka, which is about 50, 60 kilometers north of the northern point of Crimea, the little point at which it connects to the rest of Ukraine proper. And the reason that's really important is because that's where the freshwater system that had historically for decades fed, basically watered Crimea, that's where it was cut off. The Ukrainians, after the war in 2014, cut off Crimea's water supply, and you can go back through the record. I mean, it's been an ongoing and very, very heated source of contention from the Russian side and obviously from the Ukrainian side. The Russians, I think, have even tried to sue Ukraine in courts on humanitarian law about cutting off water. So they've taken control of Novokhovka, which is at the very lower part of the Dnieper, and apparently also took control of Melitopol, which is, that's to the east. So that looks like, I don't know, it's like 80, 100, maybe about 100 kilometers or more east of Crimea along the coast, heading towards the southern part of the DNR. So to sort of do a pincer movement, and in the middle there, I think, is one of the real key strategic cities, and I'd expect this to be starting soon, which is Mariupol.
You told me that the right sector leaders are...
No, not... Heaven. Well, right sector's there, but Azov. So the Azov guys...
Oh, right, Azov battalion, right.
Right. They're actual straight-up Nazis. They're also good fighters. Like, yeah. Azov guys fought that famous battle in the Donetsk airport. And they were very willing to kill and die to the last man, unlike a lot of other forces. That's why they're useful. That's their stronghold, Mariupol.
I've heard a lot of talk about their leaders having fled to Poland before this happened. So I don't know.
Who knows what to believe, yeah. You know? Who knows? Nazis,
but one thing that seems clear is if you send Russian forces north from Crimea and down from what looks like Kharkiv, mm-hmm. and west and then south from north of Luhansk, the main Ukrainian forces that were facing the breakaway statelets or whatever are going to be encircled.
Yep.
And that is going to be pretty scary for Ukraine.
Yeah, yep. That's clearly the goal here, and it's really hard to, you know, I've seen different boasts from either side, boasts that actually they're grinding Russians down, boasts that the Russians are taking all this territory. How we know very little, honestly, about the Ukrainian forces. I know they've received a lot of training from various NATO countries, but I think that's more like units are getting training. So I think there are probably some really good units that are good at, either special forces or sort of like defensive stuff. But I would imagine that the Russians would have planned for that. I mean, one thing I would imagine is that knowing Russia and Ukraine, I would imagine that Russian penetration, intelligence penetration into every area of Ukrainian military and intelligence is pretty deep, I would think. And so they probably know a lot about what... We seem to know a lot about what Russia's plans are, and I would imagine the Russians know a lot about what the Ukrainian capabilities are, where they're good, where they're not, and so on. But yeah, you're right. It looks like it would make sense, basically a cutting off encirclement of the forces on the contact line in the east against in the Donbas region. And then apparently taking or encircling Kyiv, the capital. I mean, I'm looking at Michael Kaufman's map, and he's somebody I have to take very seriously now because he called it right. And he's been saying over and over this is going to happen, and now this, he's saying it's going to happen. And also, frankly, Putin's been saying, like, we're going to get rid of this illegitimate, rotten regime, Maidan regime, that every regime that's been in power since the Maidan coup revolution is totally illegitimate, rotten to the core. That he's going to save Ukraine from the Zelensky presidency or something. And for lack of a better word, they believe it. The Russians do. I would not be surprised. They might do anything. One of those things being taking Kyiv, God knows, and putting
if
in...
If they do that, though, I mean, I've been reading about the Battle of Shanghai in 1937, and people didn't have a lot of, there weren't as many people in the world, so there wasn't as much experience with urban combat. But one thing that the Japanese army found out is that a bunch of civilians with rifles on an open field are dead meat, but a bunch of civilians with rifles in a ruined city can inflict a lot of casualties. So again, going by the odds makers, they would not enter Kyiv. But again, going by the odds makers doesn't seem to work right now.
Nope, our odds makers failed us. little odds makers in our brains. But also, like, the frustration of war can take all kinds of unexpected turns. And that's why I like seeing how brimming with just determined confidence Putin is. What happens when things start not going your way? There's no war where things always go your way. Like, what happens at that point? He's approaching this so much differently than any other war. And he's been in a few wars, and he was very understated, very careful, very deliberate in all the wars he got involved in. 99, Chechnya, Syria, exactly, and Georgia. They were very late to the game in Georgia, and pulled back, after taking everything. They could have gone right to Tbilisi, and they didn't. And it's just, everything's just very different this time. And I mean, I'm just thinking, like, think about the Kosovo War. The U.S. made a demand that Milosevic has to sign this capitulation agreement, the Rambouillet agreement. He says no, and you say, well, we're going to bomb on this day. And he says, we're not signing this. We're the great Serbian nation, whatever. And we start bombing. And I remember the media at the time was like, we are now so super high tech and so damn good and light years ahead of this, like, primitive Serbian army. Whatever they say about their will, they don't want to see their European livelihoods destroyed. And besides, we have such precise weapons and such multidimensional dominance. They're done. They're going to have to come to their knees. This will be 3 to 5, maybe 7 days of bombing and it's over. And after a week, it was like, oh, nothing changed. Nobody surrendered. And that's usually how it happens, actually. Usually you think you can bring them to their knees. And usually they don't. That's not how it works. And, so then we started, if you remember, getting frustrated and ramping up the bombings. And that's when we started bombing civilians and killing people, like journalists in TV towers. And it just got, and accidentally killing refugees. And it got uglier and uglier and uglier. And they started talking about having to do a ground war. And the thing that won it was, we cut some kind of sleazy deal with Yeltsin, and Yeltsin told Milosevic, sorry, you're on your own. And Milosevic had a nervous, like, basically a mental breakdown, and that was it, surrender. And Yeltsin got, like, I don't know, immunity or whatever deal. You can have your Chechen war now. Whatever sleazy deal was worked out. I could see a situation where Russia would surround Kyiv and control the airfield and control all these points, and then say, you've got to surrender now, leave the country, or we're going to move in. And no one responds. And then what do you do?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm sorry about the prediction here, because God knows I'm, like,
well, we're
extremely
not
worried about
it. I mean, you
that's
asked
not a prediction.
And
yeah,
it's a good
scenario.
Question.
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm sure everybody can imagine the range of possibilities there. None of them are good, and we don't know which one it would turn out to be. But yeah, maybe we should leave it at that for
yeah.
now.
And I know, because the war is like not even a day old as we're recording yeah. this. Maybe we'll just try and get this up as quickly as possible.
Yeah. This has been an emergency episode. Yeah. And I want to say again, I got it wrong. And that we're just trying to make sense of it now. And it doesn't entirely make sense as far as I can see, but we'll try to deal with it.
It doesn't make sense. And one of the, just as we were talking, I got a message from somebody. It's true too. It's kind of surprising. I mean, there are protests breaking out all over Russia.
Yeah.
And this doesn't mean that like 80% of Russians are against it, but definitely I think people see the writing on the wall here, because what this means is it's not just that everybody has such close ties to Ukrainians, and Putin's so massively misreading that it's just weird. But I think they understand in their guts that what this means is closing Russia off to the West, that, going fully the other way. And that's just not going to be popular, you know. But anyway, we're just going to have to watch it and see what happens. And this is one of the bigger events since we started this podcast, for sure. Mm. It's pretty goddamn incredible.
Yep.
And pretty awful.
And we'll just have to watch what happens. So
yeah, I think the only prediction we can make is that everything's going to get worse. The worse, the worser.
Well, I mean, from an American perspective, I mean, I can only repeat, there is feasting and rejoicing in defense contractors' boardrooms tonight.
Yep. Oh, and just imagine also the GOP, the Republicans. Yeah. When we were in power, Putin wouldn't have done this. He didn't do it. You come into power, and look what happens. You know, they're gonna turn Russiagate on its head.
Well,
and,
but it goes just as well for the Democratic centrist leadership. Like, you know, everybody has to fall into line now with Biden's lukewarmness, because anything that isn't lukewarm is dangerous.
Bad time for politics and everything. Putin's made a mess of everything, and it's bad. And let's leave it at that. And hope you feel better from the booster shot.
Yeah,
I know how that feels. Thanks everyone for being patient with us, for being for being understanding about it. And it is definitely a unexpected turn of events, big time.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
On that wretched note, let's end the show. And thanks again to everybody. And talk to you again, I guess, next month.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.